Welcome to Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. This week on Making Contact.
A national dialogue on race, as the president's laying it out, is in a sense such a great dramatization of the problem.
I use the term white supremacy specifically because there's been a lot of confusion around the term racism. White supremacy makes it clear as to who runs the system, who controls the system, who it benefits, and who it exploits.
As President Clinton continues his so-called dialogue on race, hoping to foster understanding among the country's various ethnic groups, many activists are questioning the president's approach. Some say that Clinton's handling of race relations in the United States sidesteps one of the root causes of inequities in this country, institutionalized racism. On this program, you'll hear from activists and journalists who are confronting, in their words, white supremacy. I'm Philip Babich, your host this week on Making Contact. The specter of racism has been a predominant force in American history. The first white European settlers justified the slaughtering of indigenous peoples and the enslavement of Africans by viewing and treating blacks and Indians as subhumans. Centuries of genocide, slavery, and oppression followed. Today, communities of color still face unequal treatment and, in some cases, brutality. According to Mikhail Muhurar, coordinator of the Racism and Activism Desks at the Media Watch organization Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, seldom do politicians and pundits connect present circumstances with historical patterns of racism in this country. I spoke with Muhurar about these issues. Muhurar, a longtime scholar and organizer whose work focuses on dismantling white supremacy, began by talking about the recent explosion of blacks and Latinos entering the criminal justice system.
You have a booming prison industry in this country that is quite sinister because you literally have a policy where, on the one hand, economically deprived communities have people in it, and a rising number of those people are women, who are being funneled into the prison system, and other economically deprived communities who are largely white have prisons built in their communities, and these prisons then become the foundation stone for economic development. So that is like quite sinister, and actually that penal servitude system is in fact very much related to a kind of new parasitism. It sounds like hyperbole to say that it is like a new form of slavery, but it is in fact that, because it is in fact prison servitude.
So you believe then there's more than just a bias at work then, that there is some conscious direction behind people in poor communities, blacks, African Americans, Latinos, going to prisons? You feel that there's some sort of conscious directive there?
Absolutely, and it's clearly public policy, and it's clearly often labor policy. It's clearly often policy how we're going to control, you know, groups who are being marginalized. And it's clearly related to national politics because you have a situation where, as I said before, whole communities are benefiting. Whole white communities, rural communities are benefiting. You have a situation where on Wall Street now, the privatization that's occurring in terms of the prisons, I mean, it's like prisons are a boom industry. People are being told to invest in prisons. So, yes, it is, in fact, public policy. Yes, it is, in fact, conscious decisions. And it's conscious decisions that are not new. It just continues a historical practice. You know, if you look at the patterns, for instance, of overrepresentation of minorities, you know, in prison, in among the poor, you know, among those who have been receiving welfare. These are clear historical outcomes. Cannot be denied that they're historical outcomes, but America is very mythic. America is a very mythic place. The idea of America is very mythic. So America is kind of like living in the eternal present. And the idea of a history that you have to really confront and address is like cut off altogether. You can never confront the real reasons, because to confront the real reasons mean you have to really confront what the United States of America really is about and what its contradictions really are, and they're not willing to do that.
The term white supremacy you use, maybe you can elaborate a little bit more. I think that most people think of white supremacy as, say, groups like the Aryan Nations or white supremacist ideology promoted by Hitler. Is that what you're talking about?
When I say white supremacy, the reason I use the term white supremacy is because the term racism is too nebulous. You know, there's black racism, there's reverse racism, there's white racism. You know, it doesn't identify who is the leading group, you know, that is benefiting the most from the present structure. White supremacy is a term that deals with the history. It deals with the fact that it's a structure where white people, quote unquote, people who historically have been designated to be white, you know, benefit.
With regards to people coming to terms with racism in the United States, President Clinton kicked off the so-called National Discourse on Racism, and he supposedly opened the public dialogue on this issue. You know, I'd like to get your opinion of President Clinton's handling of racism in America today, and also your thoughts on what needs to be done so people can address racism at large and also their own personal racism.
Well, I mean, national dialogue on race is, in a sense, as the president's laying it out, it's in a sense such a great dramatization of the problem, because the premise of it is that we just need to talk about this. The premise of it is that racism is just like a moral problem, or it's a problem with individuals. It's an individual situation, and we just need to get together and just have this conversation and really talk about it, linking that historical perspective with public policy, or with, you know, okay, now we're going to study this, and then on the basis of that study, we're going to have some systematic recommendations. You know, that is something that seems to be lacking in what the president is doing. Also, in this whole idea of racial dialogue, it's a paradox, because on the one hand, you have to deal with the so-called black and black-white problem, because that has, in many ways, is like the dominant paradigm in terms of America. But it is, in fact, true that you have such diversity in America, and you have an increasing amount of diversity and prominence on the part of Asian Americans and Latino Americans. And so the racial dialogue has to, on the one hand, deal with this black-white conflict as it's been defined and as it has manifested itself. And on the other hand, it has to deal with a variety of groups, how they fit into this black-white paradigm, how they contribute to a situation where the black-white paradigm is no longer pertinent. To some extent, the black-white paradigm was always an imposition on a very diverse situation, you know. So it's very, very good to have these diverse voices, but I don't think that the president's initiative is one that will bring us into any better social policy, public policy, especially since he's been leading a number of efforts which have harmed the very communities that he is now claiming to champion. It's very, in many ways, it's a very cynical manipulation, and it's insulting the notion of racism that is being projected to the American people, one that doesn't get to the structural disadvantaging of various communities, but one that reduces the whole race dynamic to one of conversation.
Are you at least optimistic that the issue of race is out on the table and people are supposedly talking about it and try to come to terms with racism?
I'm optimistic because it's out on the table. I'm optimistic. Well, I won't say optimistic. I'm cautiously optimistic, and that there are a number of very, very good works on racism coming out, a number of them written by white people themselves. The reason I'm optimistic is because the thing about America is that it is at least officially a democracy. In reality, it's a plutocracy, but at least it has a democratic veneer. And that presents a real critical challenge to the progressive movement to actually like organize and mobilize the popular forces in the country against the elite. You know, e pluribus unum means one out of many, or out of many one. But often it's a situation where the few are constituted against the many. And the bottom line of that, or one of the bottom lines of that, is that this can never happen without media activism. Because the media is playing a leading role in misinforming the public. The media is playing a leading role in dividing the public. The media is playing, you know, a leading role in justifying the horrendous policies that are hurting all of us.
I've been speaking with Mikhail Muhura. He's the coordinator of the Racism Watch and Activism Desks at the Media Watch Organization, FAIR. Mikhail, thanks for joining us and making contact.
Thank you.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. This program can be heard on over 130 stations in the United States, Canada, Haiti, and South Africa, and around the world on Radio for Peace International Shortwave. If you want free background information on the subject of this week's program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same number for tapes and transcripts. That's 800-529-5736.
To address institutionalized racism and white bias, a growing number of activists and organizers of all backgrounds are holding meetings to confront prejudice in their own lives and work. One such program is called Challenging White Supremacy, a workshop for organizers. Correspondent Travis Lee spoke with some of the group's members.
Sharon Martinez has been running the workshop since 1993. The 13-week course is geared toward primarily white activists and organizers who want to be more conscious of their own subtle forms of white supremacy, and more importantly, who want to eliminate institutionalized racism. Recently, the workshop has added an internet component where organizers conduct an online workshop. Martinez begins the class by establishing a definition for white supremacy.
White supremacy is an historically based, institutionally perpetuated system of exploitation and oppression of continents, nations, and peoples of color by white peoples of European origins for the purpose of establishing and maintaining wealth, power, and privilege. I use the term white supremacy as a synonym of racism. And the term racism, I use the definition, racism equals race, prejudice, plus power. To me, the two terms are the same. And I use the term white supremacy specifically because there's been a lot of confusion around the term racism. White supremacy makes it clear as to who runs the system, who controls the system, who it benefits, and who it exploits.
Participants in the workshop say the knowledge they take away from the training helps them recognize the pervasive white supremacy that they previously had not noticed. Workshop veteran and now online coordinator Carrie Anderson says it's a question of access and privilege.
If you're conscious of it and you're looking through a real clear race-conscious lens, you start to really see that as a white person, I still have access to go just about any place I want to go to. And there are still places where sort of the nicer the restaurants become, the nicer the stores become, the nicer the neighborhoods become, you see more and more white faces and fewer black faces, particularly fewer faces of color in general, particularly fewer African-American faces, and probably fewer Latina faces too. So you start to, as my awareness continues to develop, as I move through the world every day, I try to be really aware of and look around, you know, who is around me? Where am I? You know, I have free access to pretty much go wherever I want to go. And who are the people that I'm seeing in this really nice restaurant here? Who are the people who are in this fairly fancy shopping mall or someplace like that? And if you kind of look in terms of what kinds of people do you see in what kinds of places, you see the pattern of white supremacy play itself out in terms of who has access to be where and who does not.
As a volunteer domestic violence agency, when I'm answering the crisis line, I have such the privilege to only speak English.
Hadley Grosbeck is a white anti-racist organizer.
And to know that the whole system, you know, backs me up in that. And so when a Latina woman calls, for example, and is in a serious, possibly life and death situation, and she speaks Spanish and I don't, that to me is a deep example of how white supremacy affects my daily life and how it can be seriously damaging to someone else's life.
Amy Little, who helps coordinate the online class, says the work she does with women in the prison system has been directly affected by her training in confronting white supremacy.
When we do work inside the prisons, and disproportionately the number of, or the women inside are disproportionately women of color, and instead of our group just sort of leading ourselves and doing things that we think will benefit women inside to really talk with them and find out what is their agenda, what strategies do they suggest for us to get to the goal of improving healthcare for women inside, for really dismantling the prison system in a lot of different ways. But we're really trying to prioritize the voices of people of color and go to them to lead us in the struggle.
What I used the workshop for was that I took it back, what I learned in Challenging White Supremacy, to the agency, a domestic violence agency that I work at, and used that knowledge to organize an anti-racist task force that is mandated for the volunteers that are white volunteers to attend if they're going to participate as volunteers on the crisis line.
Monica Castillon, a Latina, has also participated in the workshop.
It's run by the white volunteers and for the white volunteers, but actually they take their direction from women of color at the agency. And so it's sort of like incorporating some of the fundamentals, such as that women of color are intelligent and they have their leaders, they have ideas of how anti-racist work can also be incorporated, even in predominantly white-run agencies that we all work at.
One of the things I think that I take into my daily life from this workshop is the concept of challenging other white people and really bringing it home to white folks that white supremacy is not about skinheads and Klan members.
Carrie Anderson.
White supremacy is absolutely about the very invisible systems that continue to privilege me and privilege you, whether we like it or not, whether we know it or not, as we breathe and sleep every single day. And that very same system continues to oppress and unprivilege and murder and imprison people of color.
As a woman of color, and as I live longer on this planet, I realize how crucial it is for me to be able to take care of my oppressor constantly in the way I express myself, in the way I talk. I can't be emotional. I can't get angry about the situations that I see happening around me or to me. So the more logical and reasonable I can be, the more I will be listened to. Wherever I'm at. But if I get emotional or passionate or talk loudly, raise my voice, then they will just say, oh, that's just one of those hot-headed Latinas trying to go nuts on us, and just ignore her. She doesn't know what she's talking about. So I always have to be constantly trying to be logical, reasonable, keeping my voice in a monotone, and basically just taking care of whoever it is that's oppressing me so that they won't get offended about my offense.
Sharon Martinez is visibly proud of the progress her students and colleagues have made, but getting other progressives to confront white supremacy has been a challenging aspect of her work. Some say resolving class issues must precede tackling racism, or that from economic justice will come racial equality.
The idea of doing either or, race or class, if you're looking at the U.S. of A, is absolutely inconceivable. Furthermore, there is no way in the world that I'm a socialist, so this is a perspective I come from. We can never, in this country, defeat capitalism, defeat worldwide imperialism, unless all the oppressed people get together. And as long as the majority of white oppressed people refuse to deal with the racism that prevents us from building the coalitions and alliances with oppressed people of color, we will continue to be oppressed. We will continue to live as exploited, as homeless, as battered.
For Making Contact, I'm Travis Lee.
Roberto Rodriguez and Patricia Gonzalez are syndicated columnists whose X column appears in 35 newspapers around the country. Based in Albuquerque, New Mexico, they frequently write on issues of social justice and race. Several of their recent columns have focused on what they call the anti-rights movement, a backlash against civil rights and an effort to gut affirmative action and social services for immigrants. Gonzalez and Rodriguez spoke with correspondent Julie Light.
we wrote about the yellow ribbons in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. I don't know if you heard about it, but people were putting out yellow ribbons in protest because they that they were living next to too many Mexicans in housing. In other words, that the housing was too overcrowded and that there were all these intercultural conflicts happening because Mexicans didn't know how to act in the United States. And then they were going around photographing people going into the houses and documenting, writing down who went and how many people and what time of the day, so that they could turn it into the federal government and argue that they were violating federal loans and local housing laws. So I think that, you know, part of anti-rights, the concept of anti-rights, is how attitudes create the laws, how attitudes fuel these kinds of laws that actively are taking away the rights of people, so that those kind of attitudes legitimize the various proposals we have to take away things like birthright citizenship.
You know, one of the differences between the East Coast and the West Coast is that consciousness. You know, I think California, for all of its negativity, at minimum has a world consciousness. I mean, Asians and Latinos exist on the West Coast, whereas on the East Coast is black and white. And that's where the power centers, you know, of the world are practically, on the East Coast, New York, you know, Washington. You know, when you deal with, say, issues like affirmative action, people don't know or don't understand the complexities. A lot of times people automatically think that Asians are against affirmative action, or that all Asians are rich, or nowadays, of course, contributing all the money to Clinton and company. So, you know, it's fraught with nothing but stereotypes. I mean, you know, a person from Thailand, you know, Cambodia, Vietnam, I mean, radically different from a Chinese American who's been here for 10 generations. You know, it's very, very, so it's very difficult to talk in that respect. For bigots, it's easy to lump everybody together in the sense as what you alluded to a second ago. You know, you see an Asian, you attack them. See, we have this friend of ours from Fort Worth, Texas, and we wrote a column. It was called Jackson is Chinese. Now, Jackson grew up during World War II when he was get beat up because they thought he was Japanese. So every time he'd go to a new school, they'd introduce him. Jackson is Chinese. Anyway, during the Korean War, you know, they thought he was Korean. During the Vietnam War, they thought he was Mexican. He was, you know, he's dark, and but it's kind of a joke. But like I said, he had to assume a new identity every war, you know.
Yeah, you know, I think, and the media has a big role in this because they largely talk about race in terms of black and white. Right? They'll go to South Central LA and they'll look at the riots and they'll have Latinos in the audience and they'll call it, you know, race, black and white. And we all know that Latinos, of course, you know, had a big part in the uprising. And so then there creates a frustration with Latinos here comes that historical trauma that we are left out of the racial dynamics. And then because other people of color don't know our history, they think that our history began on the dovetail of the civil rights movement when we've been struggling for more than 500 years as an indigenous people. And without that historical memory, and then without processing that, you know, all this historical frustration, then it of course it's going to affect the dynamics. And the other thing that that happens with the media is that, you know, the people of color, we all know that we mostly come out when we're a problem. And so what's censored is our value. What's censored is when we're cooperating. You know, and so we have to look at how, you know, censorship serves to. It's like Frady says, look at what's omitted. You know, not only what people process, but what's been left out of their ability to process information.
I'm speaking with Patricia Gonzalez and Roberto Rodriguez. They are syndicated columnists with the Universal Press Syndicate, and their columns can be read in about 30 different newspapers throughout the country. Roberto, police brutality is becoming, throughout the country, a common thread in communities of color, in low-income communities. You yourself were victim of police brutality some years ago. How do you see that playing out in the current context of anti-rights?
Yeah. Well, it's probably the ultimate anti-right. I can say that probably 95% of all people who are brutalized, you know, or more brutalized than killed, but 95% of all the people brutalized by police are people of color. And it's not accidental. And a lot of times people will confuse the person that's brutalized with the color of the officer, because they'll say, well, wait a minute, it was a black police officer or it was a Chicano police officer. And we always say it has nothing to do with the color of the officer. What this issue is about, dehumanization. There are certain peoples, you know, whether it's gender, race, you know, ethnicities, that are dehumanized. And it is those sectors that are dehumanized that are brutalized. And it just so happens that in the issue of police brutality, law enforcement abuse, it's like, it's not even close. I mean, it's probably only the media comes close to levels of discrimination. You know, it's kind of funny that the media is in that category. But you're talking, again, the overwhelming majority. And it has simply to do with the idea that this person can be bopped on the head, you know, hit, brutalized, because they're not human, you know. And somehow we've given the law enforcement the social permission to go ahead and act like the judge, jury, and executioner. Now, you know, one of the things that's dangerous is creating a movement that is anti-police. You know, I struggle my whole life, you know, not to have an anti-police movement. You know, it has to be about abuse, the abuse of power. This is an issue of the entire society dehumanizing populations. And I always say that if welfare workers were given batons, riot sticks, they'd use them. And they do use them, but in the tools that they use. You know, whether it's welfare or Social Security, you know, we've seen that where they try to take money from the handicapped, take money from the elderly, you know. So I think simply this is just one institution that is brutalizing in the manner they know how.
Patricia.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that we have written about both rape and police brutality as torture in the United States. And that people are being tortured every day, either through a system that a culture that promotes rape and violence, or through the daily dehumanization of people, you know, in the streets, mostly black and brown people who live with fear. They live with fear like a lot of other people in other Latin American countries do.
Patricia, any final thoughts on how you build a movement to confront an anti-rights backlash?
I think that it's extremely important for us to know each other's history. But we have to start to create programs with healing in mind. That as we learn history, that our own shifts, you know, our own paradigm shifts have to happen also, in the sense that we really have to look at how do we put closure to these wounds, how do we process the anger, how do we process all the toxicity that each one of us is living with in our own way, because racism affects everyone and oppression affects everyone. And so I think it's already happening. I mean, and I don't, you know, and when I'm talking about a spirituality that leads to political change. Yeah, I'm not talking about something that's divorced of that we go off into a mountaintop, and I want us to climb that mountain and find what Roberto calls that explosion of knowledge, but that explosion of just being interconnected, you know, and so I think it's already happening. It's just that, you know, it's so close to us, we can't see it. You know, we can't appreciate the real fundamental shift that's happening in this country. And it's ugly. I mean, you know, the people that I think are alive today are living a historic time in which they have been born to fight and to truly challenge and put an end to or create the new beginnings of something that puts an end to what we've been living for the last millennium. And so it means that we have to be people of strong cloth. And we are. And so that's what gives us hope.
I've been speaking with Patricia Gonzalez and Roberto Rodriguez. They are syndicated columnists whose columns can be read in about 30 different papers around the country. They also have a collection of their columns, Gonzalez Rodriguez, Uncut and Uncensored. Thanks both so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. I'm Philip Babbage. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts, or if you'd like to make a comment or suggestion for future programs, that's 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production funded by individual contributors. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. Our producers are David Barsamian, Philip Babbage, and Denise Grob. Our senior advisor is Norman Solomon, and our executive director is Peggy Law. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For everyone at Making Contact, thanks for listening.